Okay, so first I wanted to say thanks to the organizers for inviting me. And what I want to do is to share some new results from our sort of evolving understanding of the relation, the galaxy-halo connection, which I broadly interpret as the relationship between mass and light, and what we derive in particular from cluster lensing, and cluster strong lensing in particular. So we've heard this morning about weak lensing, where basically what you're doing is studying large statistical populations of galaxies, looking at correlation studies, looking at the shears from these galaxy populations. But today what I'm going to show you is that there's some interesting insights you can get from detailed modeling of individual objects, not large statistical samples, but individual objects. And the objects that I'm going to be talking about are the are clusters of galaxies, the best image clusters of galaxies to date in, as part of the Hubble Frontier Fields initiative. And so, so what I'm really going to try and get at with a bunch of different ways is to see how light and mass trace each other in the HST Frontier Fields lensing clusters. In particular, I'll be showing results from two of them for which we have really comprehensive data, not just the imaging from the HST, but follow-up spectroscopic redshifts for the multiple images, and so on and so forth. But before I move on, I want to thank my collaborators. It's our own team, which is CATS, which is Clusters as Telescopes, the illustrious simulation team, and a special shout out to graduate student Urmila Chadayamuri at Yale, who worked on this as a research project. And I also want to thank Massimo Meneghetti for providing some very interesting benchmark simulations that I'll talk about in just a minute, prior to our understanding, prior to the modeling of the Frontier Fields clusters. One of the open questions with these lens modeling algorithms that were developed by many independent groups over the past decades or so is that they've never actually been calibrated. So we never really knew what the how well they performed. Each one had independently developed these algorithms and were applying it to data sets as and when they came along. So what we did prior to getting what we believe is going to be one of the best data sets for cluster lenses is decided that we wanted to calibrate these with a simulated cluster where you knew the true, so you ray traced through a simulated cluster, and then invited independent modeling teams to reconstruct the mass distribution, as well as the subhalo mass function, and many other interesting outputs that are magnification maps and so on, along with errors, and calibrate these methods. In particular, because there have been two specific classes of methods. There have been people like me who've been for a very long time modeling with the so-called parametric methods, and then there have been people who've been doing freeform analysis. So first of all, I do want to mention that the HST Frontier Fields project, there's something quite unique about this project, and it's absolutely been wonderful because of how cooperative we have been in this project. As you all know, in order for cluster lensing data to be used by the larger astronomical community, you needed lens modelers to produce the magnification map so that the rest of the community could actually exploit the data. And to do this, Space Telescope set up this very unique cooperative kind of group structure where they invited five of us, who was competitively selected, five groups to provide magnification maps. And the idea was that because this is a proprietary, it's not a proprietary data set, it's a public data set, the idea was that we also agreed to share all spectroscopic redshifts, all other follow-up data with each other in producing the magnification maps. And this is pretty unprecedented. This is prior to publication. So I just wanted to mention that it's been a very nice example of cooperative science. Okay, so in my outline, I just want to give just a one view graph overview of cluster lensing, in particular the regime that I'll be showing you models of. And as I said, I'll first focus a little bit on calibrating lens modeling and the two simulated clusters, Ares and Hera. Not just, I won't spend too much time on the comparison of methods. We had the paper out last year, so you can look at details, and I'll focus really on the fidelity of light tracing mass and how various methods perform. Then I'll show you briefly new results from the lens modeling of this one Frontier Fields cluster, AVAL 2744, which is a redshift of about 0.3. and which is really quite an unprecedented model in terms of the number of constraints we have to do this work. It's a real paradigm shift from what we used to be. In fact, our methodologies had to, you know, we had to take a big leap forward in terms of modeling. And then I want to share the insights from comparing the Frontier Fields data. In particular, I'm going to focus on the subhalo mass function, mapping the substructure, the properties of cluster galaxies. So I'll talk about that in a minute, and compare that with illustrious simulations, in particular the iCluster zooms that were performed to mass match the Frontier Fields cluster. So I just want to point out that all the papers that have used this public data set, by not just the five selected modeling groups, but everybody's collected very nicely on this website, and I urge you to take a look at that. So much of what I'm going to focus on is based on the work, a lot of wonderful work on the lens modeling that's been led by Mathilde Jozac. And I'll talk about this paper on the comparison project, some of the highlights, as I mentioned, and then some new results, which we've just published on the subhalo mass function. So as all of you know, I'm not going to spend much time on this slide, just saying that, you know, clusters are extremely messy, complicated, but anything in life that's interesting is messy and complicated. So, but they have been very, very effective astrophysical laboratories. So they have given us interesting insights into tests of dark matter from profiles of dark matter profiles, inner slopes, outer slopes, presence of cores, concentration, as well as the shapes of dark matter halos and so on. So there's been a lot of use of clusters to derive constraints on the sort of dominant lambda CDM paradigm, and in particular compare with simulations, CDM simulations. So today I'll really be focusing mostly on substructure and lensing constraints on dark energy sort of cosmography, because the strength of the lensing depends on a pre-multiplying geometric factor. Knowing the mass distribution, you can actually try, you can simultaneously, basically, if you have really good data, try and back out cosmological parameters, for example, the equation of state. And of course, lensing, cluster lensing also affords other tests of the standard. So it's become sort of a part of our standard cosmology, cosmological constraint toolkit. This is my one slide primer, just to show you the, as you all know, you have background galaxies that are lensed by a foreground cluster, which is predominantly dark matter. And here I am already revealing my prejudice by showing you that these are cluster galaxies, and I'm going to associate the existence of dark matter subhalos with these cluster galaxies. And so I'm going to focus today really on this regime in which you can consider lensing to be a nonlinear mapping, which is a one-to-many mapping. So you have often an individual galaxy that is multiply lensed into arcs and arclets, highly elongated arcs and arclets, and mostly magnified, but with typically 1D magnified fine image. And so what we've talked about earlier today is sort of this regime, so sort of the linear regime, if you will. This is the nonlinear regime. And what I'm trying to show you here in this little schematic is the kind of range of elongations that you could get. And I purposely am showing you a bimodal cluster, and the surface mass density is coded with the pink in the background. And what you see is a departure from the tangential shear. You see a lot of local deformations. And of course, this background sheet of distant galaxies have projected shapes originally to be little circles. And this is just to show you that, you know, much of the analysis that I'm going to be showing the results of involve this sort of mapping from the source plane to the image plane, assuming some kind of prior for the mass distribution, the intervening mass distribution. And often the priors that me and our group and many other lensing groups have assumed are parametric models, particularly the pseudo-isothermal elliptical mass model for modeling the overall cluster, and then assuming some self-similar sort of profiles for the subhalos inside those four cluster galaxies in the cluster. So as I mentioned, the kind of lens mapping, this inversion of using the observed images to then work out the integrated surface mass density along the line of sight, which is of course dominated by the presence of a massive cluster, two kinds of techniques have been used. So much of the work of our group, which has over the years, over the last decade or so, we've developed this code called LensTool. It's actually a parametric code. We started out with a parametric formulation, where basically the gravitational potential, the projected gravitational potential, is really modeled as a sum of a smooth component of a certain number of large-scale smooth components, and then many small-scale components that we associate with the location. So these are dark matter subhalos that are associated with the locations of cluster galaxies in the cluster. So this is, therefore, you start out making an a priori assumption that light traces mass. Okay? So then there are other methods which are called freeform, not strictly non-parametric, but freeform is a better word for them. And these are methods in which you do not make an assumption that light traces mass, and you do not have any priors like the pseudo-isothermal elliptical mass distribution as a prior profile for the cluster and so on. And it turns out that, you know, what is different primarily between these two techniques is here because of a bunch of scaling relations that explicitly relate mass to light, for example, we'll see in a minute. These methods, you have the parameters often, the number of parameters is often comparable to the number of constraints. For these methods, it turns out that you need a very, very large number of constraints for these methods to actually converge and give you results. So as I mentioned, you know, this is sort of work that we've been refining over a very long time, the most part of 10 years or so. But it turns out that the quality of the data has really forced us to move to more sophisticated modeling. As I said, the basis for these parametric techniques that I'll be showing you results of from today are the cluster is mapped into a superposition of smooth components, so more than one large-scale component, often, if the data requires it, and many perturbers. And so this is just a map. This is an early reconstruction of the potential of ABEL 2218. And what you see, the critical region is this, the bunny rabbit, so all sources behind this region will be multiply imaged. And what you end up seeing here are the recovered. So what we are really sensitive to, what we're really looking for, is we're looking roughly for galaxy-galaxy lensing within the cluster, except that the overall magnification of the cluster actually boosts the signal, which is why you can actually get a result without having to have 100,000 pairs and so on and so forth, foreground-background pairs. And what is shown here, this is an HST image, and what you see here is the light distribution, and the red ellipses that you see are the recovered apertures within which we have constraints on the enclosed mass. Okay, so we have the mass enclosed from the signal within these regions, and they lie well outside the optical radius. Okay, so that's what I want you to note from there. And then, you know, we've done sort of these kind of visualizations where you can see sort of these smooth components, and you can see the subhalos, the substructure for these models. Okay, so as I said, in these parametric models, we are assuming that light and mass are explicitly related to each other, and for that, we adopt scaling relations that from empirical observations. So observations of elliptical galaxies, the Faber-Jackson relationship. So essentially, part of the theme of this workshop is really, the way I see it, is trying to understand how we are mapping halo masses to the velocity dispersion, to say the galaxy luminosity, so how we are actually linking properties of the dark matter halo to the luminosity of galaxies that are hosted in them. So in the work that we do in cluster lensing, in particular in the strong lensing regime, we are now modeling all these substructure as subhalos associated with the positions of cluster galaxies, and we employ the empirical relations that are seen, properties of elliptical galaxies and early type galaxies like the Faber-Jackson relation and so on. And so what we do is we scale the central velocity dispersion of a subhalo with the luminosity, with the Faber-Jackson scaling. And then we have these couple of parameters which have to do, so remember one of the, you know, even with the HST frontier fields data, we do not have enough information to actually resolve the density profiles inside the subhalos. So what we're really getting is an aggregated, integrated mass inside this aperture. And so what we have is sort of It's not quite the tidal radius, but it's a proxy for the region over which the local gravitational potential of a subhalo dominates in the lensing signal compared to the larger contribution from the smooth halo. Okay, so as I said, one of the incredible things about the Frontier Fields initiative was that it's a sort of deep imaging of 6 cluster lenses. And we've really gone from, so the best image cluster till the Frontier Fields came along was ABAL 1689. And in ABAL 1689, we had 24 families of multiple images. So we've more than doubled it. And in the data that I'm going to show you, there are more than 57 multiple image families in the cluster ABAL 2744 that I'm going to show you results from. And we have about 100 images with spectroscopic redshifts, followed up by many projects, many individual groups. And as I mentioned earlier, they were all shared. So the models that I'll be showing you incorporate the best-to-date constraints that we have. So we also have multi-wavelength coverage. There's been very interesting studies trying to not just look at the fidelity of light and mass, but also gas, light, and mass. Okay. So obviously, the big questions are, you know, what is the nature of dark matter? What? Okay, I think I'm going to be the first person who's going to go over. Okay. What we did for this comparison project is Massimo Meneghetti derived two clusters, two simulated clusters with substructure that was added in two different ways. In one case, the arrays, he added in parametric models, and for the second cluster, Hera, a semi-analytic model of galaxy formation was used to derive cluster galaxy properties. And so what was we would ray trace through these simulations, and then we gave the image files to all these groups that participated with a range of methods. So let me just quickly show you. So what I really want to show, these are the two mock clusters. This is Ares and this is Hera. And so this is the substructure. And this is sort of comparable in fidelity to the kinds of images and number of images you would have from HST Frontier Fields. So this is just to show you, you know, the magnification maps. This is the true, just to visually show you that these are all the various sets of methods. So the method that I'm talking about mostly today is CATS. And obviously, we have a bit of a heads up when you have parametric introduction of substructure. So we do very well with ARES. We do less well with HERA, but not so shabbily. Anyway, so if you look at the subhalo, recovery of the subhalo mass function, it's kind of tricky. One of the reasons why we've all resorted to parametric models is very convenient to compare with n-body simulations because of the kind of frameworks that we have. We have a framework where we are talking about halo masses and virial radii and so on, sort of well-defined physical regions. So when you have non-parametric methods, it's very hard to figure out how to compare them. But anyway, here is a comparison. So we sort of look at the deviations from the true around inner apertures, around the locations of cluster galaxies in the simulation. So what you find is that, you know, with varying fidelity, models can recover them. So once again, I want to draw attention to this one. So obviously, if you recover it extremely well, you have to be extremely narrow around one. That's M over M true. Okay, so the interesting thing is that one can then also look, one of the powers of the free-form methods is that you can actually ask the question of how well do light and mass trace each other. So you can look at the galaxy mass correlation function, which was done in a very nice paper by Sebesta and collaborators, and this is using a code called GRAIL, which is a free-form code. So as expected, in the galaxy mass correlation function, you see the trend with luminosity. So it turns out that mass and light actually trace each other extremely well in the Frontier Fields data. So I'll just skip this, which is the fidelity of all the models. So what's different about the Frontier Fields? So I just want you to note in terms of the number of constraints, prior to the Frontier Fields, you had about 55 images of about 18 galaxies in this cluster, which is 2744. And I'm going to show you some the best fit model after the Frontier Fields. So at the moment, we have about 159 strong lensing multiple images. We have 51 lensed galaxies, the multiples from the 51. And this is the best fit mass model. Details can be found in many of Matilda's papers. Okay, so what do we do? So from the Hubble Frontier Fields data, We can, as I said, when we model the subhalos, we can optimize and try to fit the strong lensing data using this prior of smooth distributions, the dark matter smooth potentials, plus subhalos at the locations of cluster galaxies. That then allows you to derive the subhalo mass function that is shown in maroon here. This is just to show you visually where how much better we can do with the frontier fields compared to previous HST with PIC2, et cetera, ACS images. Okay, so now let me move on to showing you quickly what the comparison with illustrious, because then again, it allows us to look at mass and light. So these are iCluster, these are sort of zoom simulations. So it turns out the entire illustrious box did not have a mass equivalent, so we had to do a zoom in. We had to extract a simulation from the Millennium XXL, rerun it so that you could get the 10 to the 15-ish solar masses that these cluster lenses. So the interesting thing I want to mention right away is that not only, so when you're looking at lensing properties are independent of the dynamical state of the cluster itself. However, objects that are merging that have a very high projected surface mass density because you have many substructures falling in are most efficient lenses, and our objects, the selections in the HST-FF, are obviously the most efficient lenses. And therefore, there are two things you have to worry when you are looking for equivalence in N-body simulations. You have the mass equivalence and you have the dynamical equivalence. So it turns out, of course, as you'll see in a minute, there are no dynamical equivalents, even if we are able to find mass equivalence in illustrious. So what is shown here is the subhalo mass function within the same projected region that corresponds to the ACS field of view. In black and in gray are from the full physics run and the dark matter only run. And in red is our recovered subhalo mass function from the strong lensing that I just talked about. And this, of course, assumes implicitly that mass and light trace each other via those scaling laws. But illustrious itself, the full physics run, has their own subgrid recipes for star formation, feedback, and so on and so forth. And one can ask, what is the scaling that cluster galaxies and the subhalos in illustrious follow? They follow this cyan. So there's really, at the moment, the data can really not discriminate between scaling laws that we assume versus what's put in. And so this is a very nice plot where basically showing you the analytic calculation of the subhalo mass function, comparing that with what we recover from illustrious and the frontier fields. So here is, this is my favorite plot in our paper. So here we can, one of the reasons for looking, comparing with the illustrious full physics run was that we can actually mimic our observational selection. So we do abundance matching. So we took the brightest 500 cluster galaxies in the frontier fields image and we attached the locations of putative subhalos to them. And you can do the same selection in illustrious. And when you do that, this is the match. It's really spectacularly good. And you might ask, how robust is this cutoff? Are we really detecting every 10 to the 9 solar mass halo? We are not. But what we are is that there are very, very faint subhalos, which are 10 to the 9, few times 10 to the 9, that are actually, they torque the fit because they lie right around many of these extremely elongated arcs and mass is required there. So in some sense, we are statistically detecting them. This is my penultimate slide. So when you look at, I mean, there's been a question about projection effects, so we also looked at whether projection effects could be important in the determination of the subhalo mass function, and it turns out that the subhalo mass function is actually quite robust, and the projection effects are not as important. Notice this is the run where I've not done the abundance matching. This is the overall subhalo mass function. So, but there's something very, very interesting that did show up. And that is, although we match the subhalo mass function quite well, and mass traces light reasonably well, and our assumptions look pretty robust, when we looked at the spatial distribution of subhalos, we find a discrepancy between, quite a large discrepancy between the clusters and the frontier fields. And I think, you know, we've argued that this is probably an indication that these cluster lenses are transient objects. And in fact, maybe what we need to do in terms of simulations is to actually write out more temporally densely sampled outputs in simulations, and we're probably missing these transient stages. That's one possibility. Of course, there are many other systematic issues that we have to explore. You know, Frank here, who was on the paper, is constantly reminding us that various sub-halo selection algorithms have systematics that we need to do a more detailed study to see how those could be responsible. Or, in fact, it could turn out, as I sort of told you in the beginning, that we might have mass equivalence, but we don't have dynamical equivalence in our simulation. So these are, for example, 2744 is two subclusters falling towards each other, very massive subclusters falling towards each other. I'll just stop here with the conclusions.
Compare the radio distribution, do they have roughly the same subhalo mass?
Or pardon?
Do they have the same subhalo masses?
What do you mean the?
The radio distribution here.
These are the same subhalos that have that were in the illustrious match.
But in the upper.
These are the same subhalos. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And it's really quite marked. How the in the frontier field in 2744, you really concentrated towards the center. Whereas, I mean, again, you know, we've talked about it quite a bit. That it could also be right. There's some that dynamical friction, tidal stripping in clusters, in simulations of clusters. Maybe there's something there to look at. Yep, Andrew.
So about each individual subhalo, so what is the current state of basically nailing or providing a mass estimate for individual ones, and what might be the future there? So far as I understand, it's a statistical, you have one parameter to have an amplitude, basically.
Right. So, I mean, there are very, very few cases in which you can get robust estimates of single subhalo masses. And we can probably do that. So it's done, you know, quite successfully, but arduously in galaxy-scale lenses. The SLAX team and Tommaso Treo and Sherry Suyu and Simona Vegetti, all these people have been working. And so I think what we can do in the cluster case with frontier fields level data is probably within sort of the Einstein radius of sources at 2 to 3 or something, that region. But then you would still need to model the external shear extrema, the external contribution to the convergence from the external sources. So I think that even with this quality data, we're probably going to be just statistical. And I'm often asked whether you can resolve, okay, say something about the interior, the inner density, surface mass density distribution or profiles for subhalos. No, no way.
From Simon.
So you show a mass function here for the subhalos. What radius is that mass measured within? Because the radii you showed were only a few times the optical radii, so much smaller than the radii people usually define subhalo masses.
Right, so this was the, you mean for the subhalos in illustris when we did the comparison?
Showed results here for ABEL 2744. So in the cluster, what radius are you actually measuring these masses?
So in 2744, the masses go out to about 550 kpc.
For the subhalos?
No, sorry, for the big halo. For
no,
the
I understand. What
region.
Is the radius of the subhalo?
Yeah, so that the sort of cut radius that we get that sort of scales, we're getting about 35, between 30 to 35 kpc for something that hosts an L star. So that's our calibration.
So this is the mass inside the cut radius.
The cut radius.
And you commented you only had a statistical result. So if you only have a statistical result, I'm not sure how you can plot a mass function.
No, because you scale it with luminosity.
So that's actually a luminosity function just multiplied by this, not really a mass function for the subhalos.
No, but it's not quite a full luminosity function because we are actually we're doing an abundance matching, we're taking a luminosity cut. So you're going down only to 1/100th of L star.
Yeah, I understand, but by a subhalo mass function, people usually mean a histogram of the masses of subhalos. Well, this is actually a histogram of the luminosities of galaxies multiplied by a parameter which has come from a global fit.
No, but it's not just coming from the global fit, right? These individual masses associated with these subhalos are required to match the lensing that you see.
So
they are not purely a scaling of the luminosity function, because you have to match the locations and the multiplicity of.
So you have a separate cut radius fitted for each individual galaxy.
Yes. Yes.
Ah. Okay.
Yeah.
One more question, and then we will move on to our discussion panel. So, since
I just had a really quick question. When you showed the distribution of the number of subhalos for the different clusters, I was struck by the number that 8BEL2744 had. Is that inherent to that particular cluster, or just a reflection of the greater amount of observation time and detail that it's been studied with?
What do you mean? Just the y-axis?
Yeah, I think it was a few slides before that. One more? I think, yeah, that one. So. Yep. Is that
that's a raw number, and that's how deep the HST data is, right? So we have about, in this, I didn't spend too much time on the model, so there are about 533 odd cluster galaxies that are part of the model. Because we do a luminosity cut, we do a selection of cluster galaxies down to 1% of L star, the cluster. It's a really impressive image. I just cannot, you know, the screens are just not good enough to see them.
Let's thank Priya again.